You're listening to a podcast of APA Compass, the Pacific Northwest's only Asian Pacific American public affairs radio program. APA Compass airs at 9 a.m. on the first Friday of every month at www.kboo.fm, and our archives are downloadable at kboo.fm/APA Compass. Join our Facebook page, APA Compass Radio, or follow us on Twitter. If you'd like to contact us, we can be reached at apacompass@gmail.com. Thanks again for listening.
It's very strange to be an American in the UK, because in America, I'm not always an American. When people come up to me, they usually say, "Hey man, where are you from?" I tell them, "I'm from New York City."
Yeah.
And then they're like, "No, I mean, where are you really from?" Which of course is code for, "No, I mean, why aren't you white?" Which is offensive, right? I'm being judged based on the color of my skin and not by my most important qualities, which of course are the softness and smoothness of my skin.
This is APA Compass on KBOO, and I'm Sarika Mehta. You were just listening to a bit from comedian Hari Kondabolu. Hari hails from Queens, New York, with strong community organizing ties in Seattle. His first televised appearance was on Jimmy Kimmel Live in 2007, as well as multiple appearances on Comedy Central, including Live at Gotham and John Oliver's New York stand-up show. He is a writer for the FX network show Totally Biased. Hari stopped at Portland on his Pacific Northwest tour back in May. He joined us in our KBOO studio. We began our conversation with Hari's roots in comedy.
Well, I grew up in Queens, New York. Well, I mean, I loved comedy. I remember watching Margaret Cho do stand-up on Comedy Central. This is back when Comedy Central had like three programs and they would just air them over and over again. And the special, like, I remember Margaret Cho and Jeanine Garofalo's special used to air a lot. And Margaret had the special where she was in a leather bodysuit, I remember. I think I remember. Yeah, that was right. And it was just interesting for me to see an Asian American woman perform, because up to that point, I'd really only seen like black, white, Latino performers. So it was the idea of this person is talking about their immigrant parents, and it was an acceptable thing. There's been so many performers, but like especially Margaret was the first that kind of made me think I could do stand-up. And I did it in high school when I was 17. I started a comedy night called Comedy Night, and it was basically mostly like a bunch of sketches that were old 1970s SNL sketches, and then I did stand-up at the end, and it was awful. I mean, it was great because nobody was really doing it, right? But like objectively, it was terrible. It took me a while to figure out how to write my own jokes, how to develop my own voice, and feel comfortable. I mean, that takes time. And then I went to college from there, Bowdoin College, which is a small liberal arts college in Maine, and really learned how to perform there and at Wesleyan University, where I went for a year as well. I kind of developed more of a political voice in college, especially post 9/11. After that, seeing what was happening around the country and seeing hate violence, even in New York, and deportations and detentions and things like that, I started reading more and studying more. And you know, my comedy didn't really match that voice, and I didn't really have the audience for that till I got to Seattle. And then I started to really experiment with both like longer form jokes, not just quick punchy things, as well as more honest material, saying things I actually wanted to say and believed.
That's actually my next question, is that your comedy lies more in politics and race. And this is a different trend from a previous style that ethnic American comedians seems to rely on using ethnicity for comedy, such as Carlos Mencia and Russell Peters.
Yeah.
So how do you feel about this shift away from what appeared to me as making fun of mom and dad's accents?
Right. You know, there's also a place, I think, for that style as well. And I think Russell Peters is an interesting example, because Russell Peters is not really a mainstream American figure. In the South Asian and Asian community, he's a very well-known figure. He's big in Canada. But if you go to, you know, just a typical comedy club and say his name, most people won't know who Russell Peters is. I mean, he's a very much a community figure. So his style of performing and what he writes about is not mine, and he's never been an influence of mine. But I do appreciate him in that he's the first that's broken through and made lots of money and built an audience, right? And he's a guy that, you know, dealt with racism early on in his career and wasn't given opportunities. And he started in Canada and he had to build his way to where he's at now. And again, his audience, it's not a mainstream audience. And so he's brought so many people to comedy who hadn't been exposed to comedy before. He's brought comedy to more people than possibly anybody else in the world. He's traveled to so many different countries. And whether or not you objectively look at it and say, this is something you like or I like, that's not really the point. You know, I think what he's doing is in some ways bigger. It's, again, not my style. And I have my own philosophies on what I want my voice to be and what I want to say on stage and what I won't do. And I know that, you know, Russell does use accents, which is something I've always been uncomfortable with. And I try to be thoughtful about every word I put on stage, and sometimes maybe to my detriment. Like, you might say something that you later regret. That's true in life, so why would it be any different on stage, right? I try to be as thoughtful as possible, and that's the kind of art I appreciate in general, not just comedy-wise, but art. Like, I appreciate people who made very deliberate choices because they knew how it was going to impact their audience.
So, speaking of this message, talk about your film Manoj and these experiences that you were just talking about that Manoj might also experience.
Sure. Manoj is a short film I made back in Seattle in 2006. It's been so long, right? He's a stereotypical South Asian comedian who, I guess this is a spoiler, but I play him and I play myself in the film. And the stuff that Manoj does in the film is, you know, most of it is my early material. The stuff I did when I was in college and when I started in Seattle, stuff that you did what you could do to make people laugh and whatever it took. And, you know, and part of me is sympathetic more now to that. For all performers, because as a stand-up too, the hardest thing is to make people laugh. And when you're just starting out, you're doing whatever you can, and to expect a performer when they start to have a clear voice and to know what their limits are, you have to figure out what your limits are. But at the same time, you know, I'm very embarrassed about kind of the jokes I had back then, and I didn't think I had guts on stage. I think I wasn't particularly courageous other than just being on stage and performing. I wasn't taking any risks, and I wasn't saying things I truly believed. So I had a lot of like really easy stereotypical jokes, and that's what Manoj does in the short. And some of them I wrote the day of, and it's really not that hard to write for that voice. Like, if you other yourself, it's pretty easy.
We had the recent Ashton Kutcher Pop Chips debacle in which Ashton Kutcher appeared in brownface portraying a seemingly pathetic Bollywood director for this ad. And we've also had the NBC sitcom Outsourced. What is your take on South Asians being the latest form of derogatory comic relief in mainstream television and advertising?
I don't know if we're like the latest form. I mean, I think we went from not existing to being a joke, but we've kind of been a joke for a while. I mean, you know, Short Circuit 2, Fisher Stevens was... I thought that dude was Indian. I thought, like, oh, there's an Indian actor that made it. Like, when I was a kid, like, I was excited to see that movie because it was an Indian actor. And it was a white dude. It was Fisher Stevens in brownface. Apu was, like, an achievement for us. But even though he's, like, a white dude's voice on The Simpsons, like, it was an achievement because there was something. I mean, that's how sad it was. We had something, and it was that. And honestly, you know, as much as I love The Simpsons, and as much as I love that character growing up, I don't really. I find it really messed up, and it's kind of an interesting thing because the only justification we have for that character is it's The Simpsons, though. And it's a great show. It's a brilliant show, but that character is what he is, right? It's frustrating because, I mean, all what I think we're fighting for is just the ability to be human in public. That's not asking very much. And I feel like you see that with the black community historically. You know, there's this huge period of minstrelsy, you know, like, you know, white folks in like blackface, and then, you know, black performers allowing, you know, being allowed to perform but playing really demeaning roles still, and then a slow acceptance of a few figures. And I don't understand why we have to go through all that every time, you know, and the gay community has dealt with that as well. Like, why do we have to go through all those steps? Like, this is obviously a bad idea. And part of it is something my friend Hassan Minhaj said in a response to the Pop Chips thing. We're a clownable minority, not to justify any kind of racism to any group. But I think there's something about the South Asian community that is seen maybe as docile and weak, and why would they couldn't fight back, and who cares, right? And it's something we have felt growing up. We didn't really have a voice, and we were made fun of both, you know, in school, workplace, and on television and film. Like, we're not seen as part of this. So, I mean, that's what it is. And the accent thing, you know, people have said, well, shouldn't actors have the right to play parts? He was selling chips. Ashton Kutcher was selling chips. This wasn't an interesting part. This didn't have a real point to it. Even if, you know, brown face in any circumstance, I have to seriously consider, but this certainly wasn't it. And also, in terms of the accent, somebody made a very interesting point on Facebook. A fan had said, like, another thing is that there's so many members of our community who are afraid to speak up for themselves because they hear their accents and are embarrassed and are worried that people will laugh at them. So even when they have something to say, they don't say anything. That's what this is doing. It's furthering that fear of, well, I'm going to be seen as a joke, even if I have an interesting thing to say, or even if I stand up for myself. So it's very frustrating, and especially in an era when you have Aziz Ansari and Mindy Kaling, and these are mainstream figures. These are powerful figures now, you know, who get three picture deals and get to create their own programs and are seen as not just actors, but creators of art. It's weird that we still have this as well.
Going back to what you were talking about a little bit earlier, about being a brown man on stage, talking about white privilege to a likely white majority audience. Mm. And that's part of the voice you wanted to create anyways. So yeah. Talk about that experience and your process.
I mean, it's it's fun when I perform for my audiences, like people that come specifically to see me, because it's not just going to be the mainstream white majority audience. It's like if you, whether in Portland or in Seattle, like, it's very racially diverse, people from many different faiths. The queer community is comfortable to come out, which that to me is a big deal because there's so much homophobia at stand-up shows. So that's great that I can be a safe space for people to laugh at. It's like part of me is writing to that audience, which is my audience, which is a very diverse audience and an open audience. And the other part of me also is aware of that's not what I'm going to get most times when, you know, I'm just a comic as opposed to, oh, it's a Hari Kondabolu show versus here's comic X who's performing in this town or at this college. At that point, I'm anybody, right? They don't know who I am, and I have to find a way to win them over. And it's tricky because there's a bit of a balancing act, right? Like either a joke which is aggressive has to have somewhat of an out as opposed to, you know, when it's my audience where I can say whatever I want, I don't need to worry, I don't need to soften it. Or it's like, okay, I'm going to give you a few hard ones and here's an easy joke about Weezer, you know, like something like that, you know? Well-structured, well-written, and I like the joke, but still, like, you know, not necessarily for me, coming from the heart. Yeah, I mean, it's tricky, and I don't like to compromise. And I think I did a lot of that when I started, and I did a lot of that early on because, you know, I think about my set on Jimmy Kimmel Live in 2007, and I look at that set, and I'm horrified by it. I also understand it's like your first time on television. I was working as an immigrant rights organizer. I was asked that week to be on the show. I was scared. You know, I'd never, like, the idea of being on television, I didn't plan a comedy career, you know? Like, I went to school even after all this stuff happened to get a master's in human rights. My background is in organizing and human rights, so I was on the show, and like my opening joke was about being a virgin, and it was like, you know, which is something I did a lot of early on because I felt like if I emasculate myself early, then anything aggressive I say after is kind of softened. It's okay, I think, to make fun of yourself, but I made very deliberate choices to weaken myself so the audience was in it, and I don't want to do that anymore. You know, that's not who I am. So it takes a while. You know, it took a while to get to a place where this is who I am, and you're going to accept me for who I am. And if not, then see somebody else.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to APA Compass on KBOO. I'm Sari Gametha, and I'm speaking with comedian Hari Kondabolu.
When I was living in London, I was dating this English woman. And the first 3 months I was there, it was like really exciting. She was over at my place like 3 nights a week, immediate trust. And then 4 months in, she was over at my place 4 nights a week. And I noticed she was starting to tell me what to do, like when to wake up and when to sleep and what to eat. And I'm like, this is weird. But like early on in a relationship, you have to set boundaries. So maybe this was part of that boundary setting process. I'm like, okay, let's go with this.
5 months in, she's over at my place 5 nights a week, and my brother had come to visit. And I don't know what she said to my brother, but by the end of his week there, like, he was angry at me. She had, like, turned my brother against me. It was so strange. And then 6 months in, I hated how I was being treated. I decided to assert myself, and I said, I don't like how I'm being treated. I'm a human being. I deserve more. And that's when the beating started, and I don't know why she felt comfortable hitting me, but she did, and it was terrible. I felt defenseless. I felt like nobody could help. Nobody was listening. And after 7 months, she's over at my place 7 nights a week. She has her own place. She has her own place that she's paying rent for, but she's over at my place every night of the week, eating my food, telling me what to do, hitting me, and that's when I knew this wasn't love. This English woman was trying to colonize me. And I, of course, did what I was trained to do in such situations. Nothing. I simply didn't cooperate. I used nonviolent resistance. And after a month, she finally left. And she took most of my best stuff with her. Food, art, self-esteem, all gone. And she left a few things. She left some clothes and some books. And, of course, an extensive railway system. So, for the non-South Asians in the audience, who perhaps didn't understand why there was applause, the British built a really extensive railway system throughout India before they left, and it wasn't so much for transportation for the Indian people. It was because it's really hard, of course, to plunder on foot.
Earlier this year, the State Department sent you to India as part of the Make Chai Not War tour.
Yeah.
So talk about that experience, and especially with writing jokes that are based on cultural references and history.
It was very tricky for me to do a show that the State Department sponsored. It's funny because, you know, I've struggled with not wanting to do certain, like, auditions. And then, you know, I did this tour from the State Department, and the State Department has, to be nice, a mixed record. I should say that it wasn't like the top of the State Department. It was like their cultural affairs division. So the idea was, you know, they usually bring jazz music or things like that from the States to India and try to, like, say, this is cultural stuff that we're bringing over and sharing. But I think they thought it would be interesting to bring stand-up comics, and because they know there are more South Asian stand-up comics. So my friend Azhar Usman and our other friend Rajiv Satyal, like, started this tour, Make Chai Not War. But yeah, they very graciously asked me to be a part of their tour. And, you know, my issue was, I don't want to restrict myself. I want to be the best I can be for that audience, like I always do. I do the best I can for whatever audience is in front of me. You know, it's funny, as much as I talk about not wanting to compromise or restrict myself, performing in India was hard because I didn't know what the groundwork was. I didn't know what was going to be in front of me. I didn't know. I mean, there's that State Department thing in the back of my head, like, are they going to make me not say stuff? But the other part was like, what is this audience going to understand? And also you start to realize it's not one audience. An audience in Calcutta or Mumbai is not the same as an audience in Patna, in a smaller, developing area of the country. And so you're performing in front of 1,000 or 1,200 people a night. And imagine not knowing if anything's going to work. You're basically open miking in front of 1,000 people. And, you know, it was incredible. It was an incredible rush. It was an extreme experience I hadn't really felt before. We're like, oh my God, in front of this many people, no idea what's going to happen. But it was frightening. And I remember I was talking to my parents about the stuff and really going over what I could say, what I couldn't say. And I never do that, ever. But for this, it felt appropriate. And it was like, well, don't talk about sex, don't talk about religion, don't talk about... Basically, by the end of it, it's like, don't talk about anything. It's best you don't talk about... It's best you just stand up there and just wait, and the time will pass, and somebody else will go on stage. It's exaggeration, but, like, you know, they were very worried about everything I could possibly say.
They wanted to protect you.
Yeah, basically. And also, their India is an India that in some ways is frozen in the late 70s from their experiences, right? And it's not necessarily big city India either, right? So when I got there, when I was in Chennai, that was the first place, I have this joke that I talk about dating an English woman. My mom likes that joke, and she said, it's a good joke, but change it from like an English woman that you're dating to like a male roommate, because people might be uncomfortable with a woman staying at your place in India, so it's best to just make it like take that gender dynamic out of it. And so I did the joke, which made less sense now because of that change, but I did it because, you know, she suggested it. It did fine. It wasn't as great as I'd like, but it did fine. And after the show, these young kids from Chennai, like about my age, like mid-20s, late 20s, and they came up to me dressed similarly to me. They said they were huge fans, and they were asking me, why didn't you do stuff on Occupy Wall Street? I'm like, I didn't know that would be something you'd want to hear about. And yeah, it was a good set, but like, we noticed that you seem to kind of hold back a little bit. And I'm like, yeah, what do you mean? It's like, well, we've seen your stuff online, and you held back. And that colonialism joke, like you said it was a man, but it was actually a woman. It was like a woman you were dating, so why did you change it for us? And I said, well, you know, I spoke to my parents, and my mom said that you might be upset, like the audience might be upset if a woman stayed over, so I thought it'd be easier if it was a male roommate. And he just had this look, like he smiled, but he was a little annoyed. And he said, hurry, you know we have sex in India, right? Yeah, I've seen the numbers. It's just a kind of like the shock of it. So like there was me figuring out each city as we went along. And also, it was interesting because we got questions during the Q&A sections of the shows, which we did most shows. And people said, why is your government sending you here? Why is this relevant? Why are you doing this? And also, why are you criticizing your government? It seems interesting that their State Department is sending you here. And you know, we all had critical things to say about various government policies and the way life is here. And it was interesting because, like, the people at the consulates, when they spoke, you know, they'd answer those questions, and they said, well, in the U.S. we believe in freedom of speech, and we believe in that people have the right to question the government, and what better way to show that than to bring comedians who are doing just that? We're paying for us to be criticized, basically. And it was such a good answer, and I didn't know how to deal with that. I'm like, you got me again. Yes. How do I? Well, I will say that, like, if it was Bush, this wouldn't have happened. Like, it had to be this administration, I think, for even the possibility of something like this to have happened. But it was pretty incredible. Yeah, I mean, that is what we were doing. Like, we were being very honest with our point of view. And if we didn't say something, it wasn't for political reasons. It's because it wouldn't have worked. You know, that's why we would hold back. This wouldn't have worked, which we all figured out over the course of the run, like what we did and what didn't work. Mostly for me, because the other two had performed in India before. But for me, it's like each show was like a big, an awakening. But yeah, I mean, that was one thing definitely I took away, that we were allowed to criticize our government in another country. And they, in fact, were happy we did.
It's a rare privilege.
Yeah.
Yeah. My last question. Well, what is the best part about your career as a comedian, and what are the biggest challenges?
I mean, the best part for my career as a comedian is still making people laugh, as it has always been. I mean, that is the reason I do this, you know. It's funny because sometimes people, they'll call me like a social justice comedian or an activist comedian, and I hate it. I appreciate it because I feel like it's coming from a place where they have similar values and they do the work, and I am relatable to them as a former organizer and the way I approach a lot of the things I write. But I don't like it because that's not why I do this. I'm not doing this to change the world. I believe in the things I'm saying, and I think they're funny. If they weren't funny, I wouldn't say them. I'm a comedian just like any other comedian. And also, as much as it's a compliment to say those things to me, in a weird way, it marginalizes me. It puts me in this box of like, you're this kind of comedian. And no, I'm a comedian. I do mainstream things. I get to be on television, all this. Once you put me in a box, you know, this doesn't work. Like, getting the points of view across to a wider mainstream audience is important for this to really have the weight people who are calling me an activist are calling me. Like, that's part of it. And it's well-intentioned, but it's like, I'm a comedian. So anyway, that's the best part of being a comedian, is making people laugh. I think the frustrating thing for me is the constant travel. And as much as I love traveling around the world, and it's a privilege, you know, it's a little, it's weird not being grounded in a place. I'm a person who believes strongly in community and creating community and shaping community. And how can I do that when I'm moving all the time? So, you know, I miss my days in Seattle working as an organizer, performing at night, because I was part of an artistic community, like a stand-up community that was young and vibrant. And I was part of an activist and organizing community that was as well, that is still. I miss that. And I wish and I hope I get to a place where I'm in a setting like that again with like-minded people who force me to push harder.
Thank you so much, Hari Kondabolu, for joining us on APA Compass.
Thank you very much.
I've been speaking with comedian Hari Kondabolu. You can check out his comedy at his website, harikondabolu.com. I'm Sarika Mehta, and you're listening to APA Compass on KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland.
I want to talk about the Islamic Community Center that's being built a few blocks from Ground Zero, or as it's being referred to in tabloids around the world, the Ground Zero Mosque. Now, the first issue is that it's not a mosque. It's actually a community center open to the general public, right? It is not a mosque. It's open to everybody. And just like any community center, it's going to have basketball courts and swimming pools and ping pong tables. So it's weird to hear people say things like, they're building a terrorist haven right next to Ground Zero. A terrorist haven? What kind of terrorists play ping pong? What are you imagining happening at this community center? Yes. Yes, Sears Tower, good idea. Yes. Yes, Empire State Building, should have thought of that sooner, yes. Yeah, wait. One more game, yes. Yes, what do you want to play to? We'll play to sudden death, haha. I mean, what do you think? It's a community center, what do you think is happening? So I went to this party recently. People have been drinking, and you know when people get drunk, they become a bit more honest, and sometimes honesty sounds racist, sexist, homophobic, etc. And so the party's going along, and we're getting drunker, and I hear this man say, that Ground Zero Mosque they're building, and it's the terrorizing Americans. It's just awful, right? So I go up to this man, and I say, hey man, I just want to say, it's not a mosque, it's actually an Islamic community center. And even if it was a mosque, you know what? That would be okay too. And then he turned to me and he said, well, you're just saying that because you're a Muslim. And I said, actually, I'm not a Muslim. I'm a Hindu. And he's like, well, that's like the same thing. And it's not the same thing. The first clue is that there are two different words. Also, Hindus and Muslims have been killing each other for hundreds of years. So I explained that to him. And he said, well, I'm sorry, but you have to admit, you look like a Muslim. Fair enough. I was wearing a Weezer t-shirt and Converse sneakers at the time, which all Muslims wear at all times, regardless of context. What I actually told him was, here's the thing, man. Islam is perhaps the most racially diverse religion in the world. So technically, white man, you also look like a Muslim. I thought that was really clever. He did not. Because he said, I'm a Christian, idiot. And I said, yes, you are a Christian idiot. And then he said, what? What is that supposed to mean? And that's when I lost my temper. Because the religious intolerance, I know how that works in the world, right? But that was a basic grammar joke, man. I moved the comma to the right. If you do not understand a basic grammar joke, then we have nothing in common. Well, thank you so much, everyone.